Hello and welcome to the Crisis Point Podcast. I'm Eric Sammons, your host and the editor-in-chief of Crisis Magazine. So before I get started on today's guest and our topic for today, I just want to encourage everybody to like and subscribe to our podcast wherever you might be watching or listening to it. That really helps other people find out about it. So again, make sure you hit that like button, hit the subscribe button. I'd really appreciate it. And more people who find out about the podcast, the better. Okay, today we have a very special guest. We have Father John. You know, I should ask you this beforehand to make sure I pronounce your last name correctly. Is it Lavelle or Lovell, or how would you pronounce that?
Lovell, the English Lovell. Way of pronouncing it.
Yes. Okay, Lovell, great. Father John Lovell, that shows my lack of preparation in making sure I had that name correctly. Father John Lovell, who is with the Coalition for Canceled Priests. Now, I want to give a little bit of his bio here before we go into the topic, because it's very important to understand where Father is coming from on this. Father was originally from the south suburbs of Chicago. In 1998, he entered the St. Joseph College Seminary at Loyola University of Chicago. In 2001, Francis Cardinal George asked him to transfer to Conception Seminary College in Conception, Missouri, where he graduated in the spring of 2002 with a BA in philosophy. Well, Lovell then joined the Diocese of Rockford, Illinois, as a seminarian. It was sent to Mount St. Mary's Seminary in Emmitsburg, Maryland. There are a number of people who have gone there. In 2007, he graduated with a Master's of Divinity and a Master's in Systematic Theology. Upon ordination to the priesthood in 2007 by Bishop Thomas Doran, Father Lovell was assigned to St. Thomas the Apostle Parish in Crystal Lake, Illinois, as parochial vicar and part-time teacher at Marion Central High School in Woodstock, Illinois. In the fall of 2008, he was given the additional responsibility of Associate Vocation Director for the Diocese of Rockford. Over the next 2 years, Father Lovell was given other assignments for the diocese as well. I'm going to break. I still have more of his bio that I think is important to give, some of the most important part. But I just want to say when Father sent me this bio, I was struck by the fact that I've been in enough dioceses, I've worked in dioceses to know when a bishop assigns a priest as the vocation director or the associate vocation director, that is about the highest compliment a bishop can give a priest, in my mind. I've always noticed it's like the top priests in the diocese were given that task. Because why? They're the ones who are going to bring in more vocations. They're not going to pick the guy at the bottom of the heap for that. So anyway, I just wanted to note that, to kind of give you a sense of Father's vocation, his priesthood there in Rockford. In the summer of 2011, Bishop Doran assigned Father Lovell as a full-time student at the Pontifical Faculty of the Immaculate Conception, Washington, D.C., with a residency at St. Raymond in Springfield, Virginia, in order to work on a license and doctorate in sacred theology. That's 2011. In the spring of 2012, Bishop David Malloy was appointed Bishop of Rockford, and that summer removed Father Lavelle from ministry before he could finish his degree in Washington, D.C. For the last 9 years, Father Lovell has been fighting for his good name in Rome and helping other priests across the country in similar situations. So first, I just want to welcome you, Father. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Oh, absolutely. It's great, Eric. I have to say that probably Crisis Magazine is probably my favorite Catholic periodical, and I mean that with all seriousness.
Thank you very much, Father. I really do appreciate that. Okay, so I want to talk about your story a little bit before we talk about the Coalition for Canceled Priests. Tell us a little bit about your own vocational calling. How did you know that you wanted to be a priest, and how did that come about that you really felt like you had this vocation to the priesthood?
Well, if you don't mind, Eric, let's begin with a prayer and then I can go into my story.
Thank you, Father. That's a great idea.
In the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Ghost, amen. Mm-hmm. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven.
Give us this day our daily bread and forgive us our trespasses. As we forgive those trespass against us, and lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Amen.
In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Ghost. Amen.
Thank you, Father.
I am born and raised in the south suburbs of Chicago. For those that are interested, in the Homewood-Flossmoor area. I went to public grade school and then had the great fortune of going to a Catholic high school. Not that it was so much Catholic, but I was given into and shown the Catholic world, even in the post-Vatican II era when it was starting to decline, especially that school. But I had the great fortune of having a wonderful Latin teacher who's still alive. And it was really in my Latin class that I learned much about the faith, not in religion class. And because of that, after a series of retreats in high school, I felt that I was being called to the diocesan priesthood. And being only 17 years old at the time, I just simply went to the college counselor and said, I think I want to be a priest. What do I do? And they said, well, you want to go to seminary. I'm like, oh, okay. And they handed me basically a brochure for the college seminary for the Archdiocese of Chicago, which used to be known as Niles. But a few years before I attended, they moved and changed their name to St. Joseph College Seminary. And it was located on the campus of Loyola University. It closed a few years ago. And I went there and loved seminary life. Not that it was a great seminary, far from it, but I was able to deepen my prayer life. I was able to start attending Mass at some of the wonderful churches in Chicago, St. John Cantius, St. Mary of the Angels, St. Stanislaus Kostka, almost all in walking distance, but very solid, very orthodox. I had an excellent spiritual director, and more I was just learning more about the faith and starting to notice that the archdiocese, especially the priests that were running the seminary, were not necessarily on board with the traditions of the church. In fact, one of the dean of students when I was at St. Joseph's was Dan McCormick, who is now infamous for, sadly, child molestation. But he was one of the directors there. And about halfway through my junior year, in fact, right before, a week before Christmas, I was thrown out of the seminary. They called me in and basically said, we don't want you coming back next semester. And fortunately, Francis Cardinal George stepped in and said, no, I think you do have a vocation. And he sent me to Conception Seminary in Conception, Missouri. People know the Abbey because they do the greeting cards. And I finished my degree, my bachelor's in philosophy there, was recommended on to major seminary, had a meeting with Cardinal George. And he says, well, he says, I'm going to send you to Mundelein. And I said, well, Your Eminence, I don't think Mundelein's going to take me in because I was thrown out of the college program. And he said, well, go and apply and we'll see what happens. Well, I called it. I was not accepted to Mundelein Seminary, despite the fact that I was recommended on by Conception. And I had another meeting with Cardinal George, and we both decided that the Holy Spirit wanted me to find another diocese. I spent the interim working at Midwest Theological Forum. And then in the fall of 2003, after joining the Diocese of Rockford, which is just northwest of Chicago, it borders with the Archdiocese, I was sent to Mount St. Mary's Seminary in Emmitsburg, Maryland. Had a wonderful time there. At the time that I was there, and I think even now, a very solid seminary. Was able to get my master's, as you mentioned, both in divinity and then also another one in systematic theology. Thoroughly enjoyed my time there. It was nice as a Midwesterner to get out of the Midwest for a little bit to see how the East Coast lives. And it was a great seminary because we had seminarians from all over the country, some of whom I consider dear friends today. And I was assigned at a very large parish. In fact, I was one of four priests in this parish. We all lived under the same roof and had a wonderful time, St. Thomas and Crystal Lake. Back then, I don't know if it's still true now, parochial vicars were also assigned part-time at the local Catholic high school. I did that at Marion Central Catholic in Woodstock. And then a year after that, as you gave me the very nice compliment, I was made associate vocation director, which was basically the recruitment director. And probably the happiest year of my life was that first year after ordination. Just enjoyed being a priest, was being worked very hard. And about 2 years after I was ordained, having basically juggling three jobs, teaching, being a parochial vicar, and being associate vocation director, I noticed a couple of problems at the school. We had one teacher who was pretending to be a Catholic when she was actually an Episcopalian teaching Catholic religion. And then we had another one. I was a 15-year-old girl came to me and said that she was being inappropriately touched by another female teacher. And I followed all due protocol with all of that. And I guess you would call me a whistleblower. And the diocese quickly after that transferred me to another parish. closer to Rockford. I was still the associate vocation director, and I was also teaching now at Borland Central Catholic in Rockford. I only did that for a few months because the pastor and I kind of had different views of what ecclesiology meant and means. And I asked Bishop Doran if I could go full time into teaching, which he allowed me to do. Not that I thought that I was very good at it, but I just wanted to get away from that pastor who seemed to be stuck in a 1970s mentality. And I was teaching full time at Boylan. And I was also given sacramental responsibility of a small parish about 45 minutes south of Rockford while the pastor was away getting alcohol treatment, which sometimes happens to priests. Mm-hmm. And it was wonderful. And I loved being a parish priest. And I was surprised. I am not the type of person that seeks higher office or even higher degrees. I don't even think I have the mental capacity for it. Bishop Doran thought otherwise, and he sent me to the Dominican House of Studies, the Pontifical Faculty for the Immaculate Conception, in order for me to get a higher degree. What I realized, though, before I went, was that some of the vicars in my diocese, vicars general and vicar of clergy, were not all too happy with what I did at Marian and intervening there. And all of a sudden, I started getting called in. People were complaining about me. They said I was never given exact reasoning of what the complaints were, but you know, they wanted me to go to St. John Vianney Center in Downington, Pennsylvania, which is similar to St. Luke's in Washington, D.C. I went there. Bishop Doran urged me, saying that if I got a good report, he would make all of this go away that the vicars were going after me for. I didn't even know what it exactly was. Got an excellent report. Bishop Doran considered the matter dropped, sent me to Dominican House of Studies. And then while I was at Dominican House of Studies, Bishop Malloy was appointed bishop and ordained. And 6 weeks after that, on July 5th, we just had the 9-year anniversary a few days ago, he removed me based on what these vicars were telling him. I mean, it was basically secondhand information. He didn't even know me at all. And since then, I've been fighting in Rome, both in the Congregation for Clergy, the Congregation for Doctrine of Faith, and then eventually the Apostolic Signatura for my good name. That is a very quick summary of usually a talk that takes several hours and might even involve a few martinis. But that is a quick summary of that. But I'll tell you this right now before I hand the microphone back off to you. I love being a priest. I love celebrating Mass. Would I like to be celebrating Mass for the people with the congregation and hearing confessions? Absolutely. But I've certainly deepened my prayer life these last 9 years.
I bet. Now, so this incident at Marian, do you know, did anything happen to the teacher that you reported? I mean, were they removed, or was there an investigation or anything? Or do you even know what happened after you were transferred?
They were removed. Okay. I'm not privy to what the investigation was. The one that was masquerading as a Catholic was removed almost immediately.
Right.
That was that. The diocese didn't have a problem with that. It was the one, though, that the high school girl reported to me, and I eventually reported to the diocese. In fact, in less than an hour, I reported it to the diocese that they tried, from what I heard, they tried to keep this teacher on, but the superintendent of schools, a wonderful Dominican sister, basically said no and got rid of her. And then they quickly retired the Dominican sister as superintendent of schools. I don't know why they were protecting this teacher. I don't know why they would start going after me because of that. You know, I was even told by not only Bishop Doran, but by the vicar of clergy, who was very much the vicar of clergy at the time, who was very much my enemy. I didn't know it at the time, but he was, that I did the right thing. I mean, they kept telling me, this is exactly what you're supposed to do in this situation. Thank you for doing it. And the whole time is that, you know, behind my back, they're starting to start a story of me having problems with young men and all of this. And again, never an accusation, never an allegation. Still to this day, I do not have an accusation or allegation. It's just this innuendo that starts. And you're starting to see it with Father Altman. You know, it's the whole language of, well, we have concerns. You know, people have been complaining. You know, nothing exact and nothing that can point to what Father Altman or what I did. And we're starting to notice that there are several priests, hundreds, possibly even thousands across the country that are being removed because they're standing up for the truth. And I noticed last week I was with Father Altman when he received his decree from the bishop removing his faculties. It even though it was a different diocese, it looked like a carbon copy of the decree against me. And what that clearly showed me and told me was that the bishops are working in concert to do this. Now, why? That is an excellent question. And I think there's different reasons for different bishops. But in the end, and we see this with what's happened the last year with COVID, is that the bishops rely very heavily on lawyers, not the presbyterates, who are supposed to be, you know, the council of elders. That's what presbyter means, an elder. They listen to lawyers and they do whatever they can to avoid a lawsuit. And so when people said to me, I was surprised that all the bishops across the country shut down all the churches and masses, I wasn't surprised because they're worried about reputation and how the outside world views them. And it's sad that we've gotten to that, but here we are.
Yeah. So, I mean, do you suspect, I mean, some of this is speculation, but I mean, obviously, first of all, this happened after the 2002 and the Dallas Charter and all that. So for people who want to make sure they put it in perspective, this is not the 1990s or 80s when a lot of this funny business was going on a lot. I mean, it still was going on after 2002, obviously. But this is a time where the church was keenly aware of the need to at least have appearance of not allowing this type of stuff. Yet it seems like they still resisted people who spoke out. Do you think it was, if you were along with the whole program of like liberal Catholicism and very watered down Catholicism, do you think it's more likely that they wouldn't have come after you for what you did, Marion? Or do you think it was more they had some relationship with the teacher who was fired or got rid of? I mean, what would you suspect was the reason?
It's odd that they went to bat for this lay teacher. I think that if I was more liberal, if I towed the party line, if I did not preach against abortion, contraception, and such, if I was not a huge fan of the traditional Latin Mass, I think I would probably still be in ministry. You know, one of the things that they did tell me is, well, you just come across as arrogant. And let me tell you something, Eric. When you're told by chancery officials and vicars that you're arrogant, that might be one of the greatest compliments somebody can receive. It's the old adage, I can't remember who it's from, that when the devil curses you, take it as a blessing. You know, when somebody that works in the chancery tells you you're arrogant, you're probably the exact opposite of that. And I have my faults, just like all of us. But, you know, when they say that to me, I'm just thinking to myself, well, give me clear, concrete examples of something I did wrong, something that warrants, similar with Father Altman, something that warrants him having his faculties removed. Because I'm not a canon lawyer, but I can read canon law. And even though I don't have it right in front of me right now, I can tell you that canon law makes it quite clear that to remove a priest's faculties, it has to be for a grave reason, especially confession, especially anointing. And to do this is just ridiculous because I am not technically suspended canonically. In fact, I'm quoting verbatim, I am removed on administrative leave in a non-penal, non-judicial way. And I've said this before, I said this in Lombard at our event, at our kickoff event. If you could tell me what that means, please, because my canon lawyers don't even understand it. We're starting to get a better idea after 9 years that the bishops are now sidestepping canon law in order to remove priests and keep them in limbo. Right. You know, and I always tell people, I am more than happy to do a background check, federal or state. You know, please tell me what crime I've committed, what delict I've committed that warrants this. Because I'll tell you something right now, Eric, even Rome has come out and said, Father Lovell's committed no delicts. But then they come out and say, but we're not going to go against the bishop. And they basically say that the bishop does have the right to remove any priest for any reason. Again, in a non-penal, non-judicial way. But they do say that it can only be temporary. But then they never put a time limit on temporary. So I'm thinking, well, 9 years, you know, how much longer before we start to see this as perpetual?
Right. It's amazing because it sounds like it's just a big, huge loophole that the bishops have found that they can sidestep, as you said, canon law. They can sidestep any issues, because a lot of Catholics don't realize, a lot of lay Catholics, I found this out when I was working for a diocese, that priests have definite and specific rights under canon law. The bishop can't just do anything he wants with them. In most cases, there's has to be reasons, but it sounds like there's this loophole where he can do this. Now, what was the actual reason given to you by Bishop Malloy? What was his actual reason he gave to you when he suspended you?
So basically what it was is I've been hearing stories. Again, it's all in vagueness. I've been hearing stories, arrogance, you're not very pastoral, you don't get along with people. There seems to be issues about grooming. And let's get something straight here, all right? There are priests and there are laymen who have problems with grooming and grooming children, all right? But to just make a blanket statement like, well, there's grooming concerns. Well, you have to be a little bit more specific than that, all right? And to cite that is basically claiming that I've committed some type of crime against children, which I've never been accused of. And, you know, one thing is that the successor in the vocation office, who was no friend of mine, basically wrote to Bishop Doran and said he thought it was odd that so many of the seminarians, when I was associate vocation director, recruitment director, so many seminarians put me down on the application as one of the reasons why they were going into the seminary. And I thought to myself when I read that, he thought it was a problem. I read that and thought, here's the problem of the church in a nutshell. In any other company, in any other profession, the recruitment officer would get a raise and a promotion for doing his job and bringing more into the company. But in the Catholic Diocese of Rockford, it was looked upon as a problem. Why were so many young men putting Father Lovell down as the reason why they entered seminary? And I'm thinking, well, they went to the vocation camps. I talked at their schools. I led their Quo Vadis groups. That's what was the young men's groups that were called in the diocese. And why is that a problem? I've never had any inappropriate conduct with anyone. And so why come out and say that I did or even hint at it? Is that even saying that I did? Is that I was just, they were hinting at it, that this must be a concern. And what you see is in the Diocese of Rockford, when I was ordained, I was one of seven. Father Jim Parker, who's the latest victim of Bishop Malloy, was one of 12 ordained in 1 year. And now we had three ordained this year for Rockford. Next year, I think there's one. And then we go 2 or 3 years in a row with there's going to be zero ordinations. It's just completely dried up.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's almost like they don't want vocations. And I think it's true. They don't want certain type of vocations. They don't want vocations of priests who are more traditional, Orthodox, or, you know, preaching the faith. Now, one thing I've noticed is that, like, I know of a couple examples of priests who are in like a similar situation to yours, where they were solid priests, they were doing their job. But like the other priests who were definitely on the more liberal, heretical end weren't happy with them. And so they'd start talking about the fact that they're arrogant or they're not willing to work with them or whatever. And the bishop ended up moving, like basically gave them the suggestion, kind of pushed them to transfer somewhere else. One went to a military diocese, one went to another diocese. And I wonder, why do you think that's wasn't kind of given an option for you of like, well, you know, we're not really happy with you. Okay, fine. Why don't you look into maybe being transferred and I'll give the okay to transfer you. Why do you think that? Because obviously, I mean, that would seem to be a cleaner break for the bishop than having to have you, you know, under, you know, in the diocese and kind of still existing in this limbo.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the reasons is that Bishop Malloy, when he was general secretary for the USCCB, and right before that, he was associate general secretary for the USCCB. He lived in Washington for almost 10 years. And he was one of the main architects, or at least main secretaries, on putting together Protecting God's Children. And I think when he was ordained bishop, brand new, he thought he needed to be tough on problems. he needed to be tough on situations like this. He didn't know the whole story. He was getting it only second or third hand, but he thought he needed to be tough because I think in his opinion, he was better than Rockford. You know, he had his sights set on bigger dioceses. And one thing that I'll tell you right now, Eric, a lot of people ask, what can we do to solve this problem in the church? And I say this, stop transferring bishops. When you're made a bishop, ordained a bishop for a diocese, that's your bride, as St. Francis de Sales says. You know, there should be only an extreme reason why you're moved. And, you know, Pope Benedict, when he was still Cardinal Ratzinger, a couple of Italian cardinals, I want to say Florence and Genoa, but don't quote me, actually wrote an article basically saying we have to stop this transfer of all these bishops. I mean, look at McCarrick. McCarrick was auxiliary of New York, Metuchen, Newark, Washington, D.C., four dioceses in like 30 years. I mean, that's just ridiculous. And but these cardinals basically came out and said, we need to stop this. And surprisingly, prefect of the Congregation for the Doctrine of Faith, Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, came out and agreed with them. Mm-hmm. But it hasn't stopped. And I think that's one thing that can be stopped. But getting back to Bishop Malloy is that he thought, I have to be tough on this. And what's funny is he started taking out priest after priest after priest. There's anywhere between 12 to 18 priests in Rockford that have been removed. And I'm going to touch on that in a moment. But what is interesting is that the vicar of clergy, who eventually became the vicar general, one of them, for the Diocese of Rockford, Bishop Malloy had to remove him as well. He put it back in ministry, retired early for medical reasons. But I thought, when he finally removed this Monsignor, that Bishop Malloy might step back and go, wait a second, I might have been given bad information by this man. Let me go back and look at all these cases of these priests that are sidelined. And I would love to go to another diocese. I would love to go to an oratory or something like the Fraternity of St. Peter, you know, Society of Apostolic Life. The problem that, and the reason I don't necessarily pursue that right now is because mixed blessing, I'm now down here living with my father back in the south suburbs of Chicago. He's in his 70s now. He's getting elderly, and I'm his full-time caregiver. You know, similar to Father Altman, he takes care of his parents that live in the rectory with him. God bless him. So I don't pursue that aggressively right now because of that. But at the same time, there's no reason why I cannot be helping out at parishes and taking care of my dad at the same time, especially if there's no delect. But I always tell priests, especially those like Father Parker, who are just starting off in this situation, be careful about wanting to go to another diocese based on who the bishop is, right? He might be a great bishop or better than average. And I'm thinking Strickland or one of them, but they're going to eventually retire. Who's going to be their replacement? You know, I mean, don't become a priest somewhere based on the bishop. That's a fluid situation, you know. I always tell priests, find a good oratory, find a good Society of Apostolic Life where secular priests can live in a community that's solid.
Right.
And that's the best thing to do. But again, Bishop Malloy doesn't want to make it look like he made a mistake. And a lot of bishops have that problem. And you see that with COVID, Eric. You know, I mean, how many bishops have come out and said, you know what, we handled that poorly this past year. We could have done a better job. They don't want to say that. They don't want to admit that.
Right.
But they've upset a lot of Catholics, both clergy and laity.
Yeah, that's for sure. Now, one thing I just wanted to mention was you're talking about not transferring bishops. What's interesting, of course, is in the early church, that was the rule that you weren't allowed to transfer a bishop. In fact, I think it's in the Council of Nicaea itself, a decree that bishops aren't to be transferred. That basically, right, once you're a bishop somewhere, you're there for life. And so, you know, like, for example, the Bishop of Rome even was selected from the priest of the diocese. It wasn't like they grabbed somebody from somewhere else. But so I think there is a lot of wisdom, and the early church saw the wisdom in that, because I also know of a bishop or two that are in smaller dioceses that have basically made it clear that they would love to move on to bigger and better things. And that just, it's a bad attitude for a shepherd to be looking at his sheep as just a temporary stepping stone to another diocese.
Eric,
now,
can I just interject, yeah, sure, real quickly? On a diocesan level, I think all priests need to realize there's no such thing as a bad parish. All right. I mean, probably one of the worst parishes ever in history was St. Sixtus in Ars, France. I mean, it didn't even have a real floor. It had a dirt floor. It was the room that I'm sitting in, the bedroom that I'm sitting in right now. The church was almost just a little bit bigger than the room I'm sitting in now. And look what St. John Vianney did.
Right.
You know, so when I hear this, I'm like, I don't think there is such a thing as a bad assignment or a better assignment. And a lot of times, especially traditional Catholics or traditional-minded Catholics, faithful Catholics, whatever term they want to use, is they always want to point to, well, this must be a homosexuality problem. And there is a homosexuality problem in the priesthood, no doubt. It's worse in some dioceses than in others. But I think the bigger overarching problem in the clergy, especially in the United States, is not so much homosexuality, as bad as that is, but is the, those that want to move up the chain, move up the ladder, is careerism. And priests need to realize, look, it's about Jesus Christ. It's not about the nicer parish or the nicer rectory. Or the more donations. And you see a lot of priests, especially in my diocese, who stay silent and go along with what Molloy's saying because they're in a cushy place. I hate to say it, but it's true.
Yeah. Now, what have you, so it's been 9 years now. What have you done canonically speaking to try to fight against this removal? I mean, what can a priest do in this situation? What have you done?
In 2012, and again, I'm not a canon lawyer, so I'm going to be paraphrasing this. I'm not using correct canonical terms. In 2012, under Pope Benedict, you had the option, and I was told this by one of my canon lawyers. I have two excellent canon lawyers, by the way. And one of them said, there's two routes. You could do a hierarchical recourse, which is administrative, where we appeal to the Congregation for Clergy, and I'll get into that in a moment because that's exactly what I did. Or you could start a contentious case via canon law. And that means a trial first in the tribunal of your diocese and then in the appeals court, which is usually the archdiocese. So for me, it would be Chicago. And we decided in 2012 that a trial canonically would take several years, while a hierarchical recourse would only take several months, maybe a year or two. And so we decided on that course of action. However, from my understanding, Pope Francis has basically eliminated contentious trials canonically for such situations. And now everything has to be done by hierarchical recourse. If I'm wrong on that, I will tell you right now, my canon lawyers who will watch this video will correct me, which is fine because I'm not a canon lawyer. But that said is that we started hierarchical recourse. We went to Rome. First, Rome agreed with us, suspended Molloy's decree. When his first decree, he actually tried to suspend me. And it was a poorly written decree. Rome, in July, immediately suspended it. And Eric, you know, probably better than most, that Rome shuts down in August, right. And they usually take most of July preparing to shut down, and take most of September warming back up. Right. You know, the congregations, especially in 2012, did not start their year until the academic year started in Rome, which was around the Feast of St. Francis. And so they immediately suspended it. And Molloy pulled a trick. I call it a trick. He'll call it being savvy bishop. He removed that decree. And then the very next day, he issued a decree removing his original decree. And the very next day, August 31st, 2012, I'll always remember the day, I received a new decree where no longer are the words suspension used or canonical, but now again, this term non-judicial, non-penal way. And then he flew over to Rome and convinced Cardinal Piacenza at the time, the prefect for the Congregation for the Doctrine of Faith, to send my case to the Congregation for the Doctrine of Faith, which had jurisdiction for the abuse of minors. Now, I was not aware of anything against me when it comes to abuse of minors, but Bishop Molloy didn't send it to the Congregation for the Doctrine of Faith because he was worried about me committing a crime against a minor. No. He realized that if he sent it to the Congregation for the Doctrine of Faith, at the time under Cardinal Levada, that it was going to sit on a desk for years before anybody looked at it. In 2012, the Congregation for the Doctrine of Faith had one person looking at about 11,000 cases. And he knew that it was just going to sit on a desk and collect dust, and it did. 3 or 4 years went by before finally one of my canon lawyers just started pestering them and started just knocking on the door at the congregation in Rome saying, where's Father Lovell's case? Why is it still sitting here? And lo and behold, because of that pestering, the Congregation for Doctrine of Faith came out and said, we have no competence with Father Lovell's case. He did nothing wrong when it comes to the abuse of minors, and they sent it back to clergy. Well, now, Congregation for Clergy, 2016, Pope Francis, now Cardinal Stella, who just recently retired as the prefect, and we've heard stories that Cardinal Stella always agrees with the bishops, always. Mm-hmm. No matter what, Cardinal Stella is going to agree with the bishop. He's very pro-bishop. And we always do. Hierarchical recourse favored the bishop. For example, a bishop can make a statement, Father Lovell did this, and Rome just takes it as fact. They don't ask for evidence. They just assume the bishop is not lying to them. And not only that, the bishop can send them things. I know this from my case, but I also know this from priests around the country. Any bishop can send Rome files or documents, affidavits from other priests that the victim, the priest, being accused of whatever, is not shown. And so they're very much stacked against us. The cards are stacked against us for this. And so eventually, in a few months after my case returned to Congregation for Clergy, they ruled that the bishop had a right to remove me, but they made it clear that it could only be temporary. And so we appealed that to Apostolic Signatura. It sat there for many years. I had to pay a lot of money. The Apostolic Signatura is not cheap. I had to pay about $10,000 in lawyer fees, because the Apostolic Signatura, similar to the U.S. Supreme Court, you have to be an approved lawyer to argue in front of them. So I had to get another, I had to get a Roman canon lawyer to do that. I did not pick the best one. We took her on advice, but we could have gotten better. We only know that in hindsight now. But just recently, the Apostolic Signatura said, you didn't make a case here. We don't see why we should overturn what Congregation for Clergy said. It's sad, but it's true. But again, even the Apostolic Signatura in their verdict said, we clearly see that Father Lovell has committed no delict. However, the bishop does have the right to remove him for precautionary reasons. And what it comes down to is, what little I have in my documentation, I've shown to psychologists, I've shown to lawyers, I've shown to canon lawyers, and all of them independently of each other, Eric, have said, it looks like Bishop Molloy is not so much concerned that you did something, he's worried that you might do something. And Eric, you know as well as I do, as Catholics, we're all capable of great sin. And we don't punish somebody because they're capable of doing something evil. If we are, we all have to go to jail. It's as simple as that.
Right. It's like that movie, The Minority Report, where they were arresting people before they committed because they could predict the future or something.
Exactly.
I think it sounds to me like one of the real flaws here is, it's understandable to give the bishop the authority to remove faculties from a priest on a temporary basis because of some concern. I mean, I think that sounds like a reasonable authority for a bishop to have. I think, though, it sounds like in canon law, there needs to be some type of time limit so that a priest has a right, you know, like we have a right to a speedy trial. I mean, the reason for that is because you could keep somebody in jail in America if you didn't have this, you could keep them in jail indefinitely till they die because of just the kind of pushing off the trial. And it sounds like the same thing is needed in the church, because if there's a real concern with your potential whatever, okay, fine, let's hear it out. Let's have, you know, see if it's true. And if it's not, but the point is, it can't just be the bishop as long as he feels like that, because there has to be some type of freedom given to you if no crime has been committed, like you said, has been clearly shown. I mean, they've never shown any crime, then, you know, canonical or otherwise, then they have to let you at some point be free to pursue. I mean, if the bishop says, listen, I don't want you here anymore, okay, that's his right too, because he's the bishop, but he has to give you freedom then to go elsewhere, which really what he's doing, though, is he's keeping you on a leash, but completely unable to celebrate sacrament. So it sounds to me like that's one of the big issues here, is just the temporary not being defined. I mean, even if you give it 5 years, I mean, you know, something ridiculously long, that's better than your 9 years of purgatory that you've spent.
Granted, and I completely agree with that. And one thing at the Coalition for Canceled Priests is, you know, we're not saying that we should be sheltering known criminals. Of course not. I mean, but at the same time, everyone in this country and even in canon law and Roman law, which both church law and American law is based on, is that we should be given the presumption of innocence.
Right.
And, you know, and I've said this before, and I'll say it again, I'll say it to you. Nobody really picked up on this, but when Cardinal Supich removed Father Flager back, I think, in January or February, he wrote a letter to St. Sabina. And of course, we know Father Flager is back in ministry. We also, you know, don't necessarily agree with his theology or his ministry. But that said, Cardinal Supich said in the letter to parishioners, we should not assume guilt or innocence. And I read that and thinking, wait a second. Yes, we should. We should always presume innocence.
Right.
You know, yes, victims need to be taken care of. Absolutely. But the whole point of Coalition for Canceled Priests is to say there's a lot of priest victims out there. And we have Liz Yore. We even have Janet Smith, you know, who are very good advocates for children, excellent advocates for children, coming out and saying, you know, there is now a problem where innocent priests, solid Orthodox priests, are being punished because they're not going along to get along. They're not being yes men. And what we have to realize is that what Father Altman is doing, what I'm doing, is this is our rights. We're not being disobedient. And a lot of times what we have, and it's cliche because we learn a lot of our faith, sadly, now from popular media, is that a lot of people are like, well, you took a vow of obedience. I'm like, I never took a vow of obedience. I took a promise of obedience and respect to the bishop. That's quite different than a vow of obedience that a religious takes.
Right.
That's quite different. And it's spelled out in canon law. And we're just exercising our rights. And I know this because if I was disobedient, Bishop Molloy could then start a trial against me for being disobedient. And he's never done that.
Right. I just talked about that on my last podcast, was just the idea that this idea of obedience, we have a very one-sided view of what it means in the church. And it's also very like a misunderstanding of a slavish idea of it. But like you said, diocesan priests, their relationship to their bishop is not the same as, for example, a monk to his superior.
Correct.
Now, it is more than like a layperson to the bishop, but it has built-in rights in canon law. And that's to prevent abuses like this. And it sounds to me like what's happening is that the legitimate need to weed out the predator priests, the pedophiles and the, you know, ones who abused young men and all that, that's legitimate. We need things in place for that. But it sounds like some of these bishops are using it for their own personal desires of weeding out priests that they just don't like. I mean, that's essentially...
You're making a very good point, Eric. And one thing the Congregation of Clergy did say in my defense was that Bishop Molloy was not following his own guidelines and the rules of the Diocese of Rockford in how he went after me. And we have to realize, whether we're diocesan priests or whether we're the laity, both men and women, the bishop is supposed to be our spiritual father in the diocese. He's supposed to be our shepherd. Okay. And not a bureaucrat. And one thing that disturbs me, especially with Father Altman's case up in La Crosse with Bishop Callahan, or now Father Jim Parker, a beloved pastor in the Diocese of Rockford who knows how to raise money and raises money well, is that both Bishop Molloy and Bishop Callahan did not act as true pastors. Right. Take example, Father Altman. He was just removed last week. I was there with him when he was removed. And Bishop Callahan couldn't even go to the parish that weekend to tell the people that. He had to send a priest who was 86 or 87 years old to take all the masses, because for some reason they don't have an administrator set up yet. It's going to be coming in a couple of weeks. And to read this statement from Bishop Callahan. Same with Father Parker in Rockford. The bishop never bothered to come down. You know, it's like, Bishop, if you're truly following what Pope Francis says, he says that shepherds must smell like the sheep. Get down there. Get to these parishes. You're the true pastor. You're the true father. And minister to these people. Be out there to answer it. But again, and we see this with COVID, the bishops are listening to lawyers. And they're scared because they don't want a lawsuit. And they don't want people yelling and screaming at them. Nobody wants it. People yelling and screaming at them. You don't, I don't. But at the same time, if you were worried about that, why did you say yes to becoming a bishop? Because a bishop should be out there on the front lines, especially in situations like this.
Right. And you make a great point about the bishop being our spiritual father. it's particularly for the priests. And because our obedience, the authority of a bishop isn't the authority of a boss. It's the authority of a father. A father has true authority over his children, and the children should follow that authority. But what father would ever abuse that authority because he didn't like one of his kids or didn't, you know, that would be a terrible father. And there's a legitimate point to that kid saying, "Dad, you're not obeying, you're not following the duties of being a father here."
Exactly.
I need to call you out on that, because if for example, my son, for example, if I was not treating him well, he's an adult now. If he said to me, "Dad, I don't like the way you're treating me. That's not right." If I'm a good father, I listen to that and I say, "Okay, let's take a step back, because I'm not your boss. I'm your father." And so all that obedience is out of love. And I think that's seems to be what's missing here. Now, we're getting a little bit long on time, but I want to talk now specifically about the Coalition for Canceled Priests. First, did you start this? Are you the founder of it?
I'm one of the founders. It is, let me make it clear, it is a lay-led, lay-run organization. I'm one of the spiritual advisors.
Okay.
There was a group of us for about the last year and a half that were looking for an apostolate. And when Father Parker was attacked, I said to the group, came together in prayer and said, "This is what God is calling us to do." It was amazing. In less than 2 weeks, we put together a 1,000-person event in Lombard. Had Liz Ure MC it, had Father Altman be the headliner. It was great, and it went very smoothly.
Yeah, so I saw that. So, and I'll make sure. Now, your website is, give your website address. I'll put it in the link, but go ahead and give it now real quick.
It's very easy. It's all one word, canceledpriests.org. We normally spell canceled with one L, but we now bought the domain with canceled with two L's.
Right.
Father John Zulsdorf, Father Z, always kind of, you have to know Father Z, but he always kind of pokes fun at us that we're spelling it with one L. But I've been told by grammarians that it's spelled correctly either way.
It is.
One L or with two.
I have it as two here. So on the screen here. So, but either way is true. I actually looked it up myself to make sure. I think it's more commonly in America, it's one L, and in England, I think it's two L. So I got the English spelling. You got the American spelling there.
Yeah.
Now,
well,
we
did it with one L because we wanted a shorter URL address.
So yeah,
that
exactly.
Was the whole point.
Now, what is the purpose then of the Coalition for Canceled Priests?
To defend the rights of all victims, both priests, laity, both adults and children. We want to get out there and basically tell people, look, there's an injustice going on here. There's priests that are suffering. Many of the priests of Rockford, you know, live on a mere pittance every month. I get $1,700 gross to live on. That's to pay rent, to pay utilities, to eat, and all of that. And I've been very fortunate. I've had very good donors. Obviously, look at Father Altman, who's raised, what, $750,000?
Something, yeah, crazy.
It's amazing. Father Parker's raised, through the coalition, especially Father Parker's almost at 150. But, you know, priests need to pay for lawyers, for canon lawyers, neither of which are cheap. Canon lawyers are cheaper than lawyers, but not by much. You know, and we also want to be a place where priests that are scared, priests that are afraid to come out to say, come tell us our story with complete anonymity. You know, we're eventually going to start running not only more conferences, but even doing retreats, you know, doing workshops for priests, you know, allowing them, because a lot of us can't afford to go on vacation, you know, so, you know, a place for them to get away. Now, when I say that, I'm not saying we're all going to Maui or all going to Tahiti, no, but, you know, a place where we can rent a house, priests can get together, share their stories, share a laugh. Because one thing a lot of these priests are doing, including Bishop Malloy, is that they're hoping to isolate us. And everyone, priests, laity, married, not married, we have to live in community. We have to have others around us. And priests especially. And I'll tell you real quickly, is that right before the Lombard event, Father Altman, who admittedly is perpetually late, came down, and all the priests that were there, most of them at least, we all went out to dinner beforehand. And I could tell immediately right there, Father Altman needed that. He at the time, he was still pastor running around. He was tired, and he just enjoyed being able to have a nice meal with priests, to shoot the breeze. I mean, that's what we all need, but that's especially what priests need.
Yeah. So if a priest, do you have a if a priest has is being threatened with cancellation through suspension, through removal of faculties, what have you. Is there a place, should they go to the canceledpriest.org website? And is there a place, a way they think we put in contact with you?
Absolutely. On the website, not only do we have a PO box, but we're going to have email addresses up there. We already have canceledpriests@gmail.com. I have an email address now, Father Lovell. You spell Father out completely, two words, but as one, Father Lovell, no space, @canceledpriest.org. Again, just one L in canceled. Always reach out to me. We're starting to get together a list. Liz Yore is helping us to get an excellent list of civil attorneys, but we're also putting together a solid list of canon lawyers that will be able to help priests, because it's crucial for priests like Father Parker, like Father Altman, who are just beginning this process, to make the right decisions at the beginning. If I could go back 9 years ago, there's a lot of things I would have done differently. And one thing that Father Altman is doing correctly is he's staying out front of the story. He's controlling the narrative, all right? And people might say, I don't know if I really like Father Altman's tone. Completely, you're right. But one thing that conservatives have to realize, and I hate using that term when referring to faithful Catholics, but it is very similar to what is going on in the outer church. We love to eat our own, and we have to stop that. We have to unite. You know, we have to say, okay, you know what? We might have our differences here, but the other side, the left, is going to divide and conquer us if we keep picking on each other.
Right.
And that's one thing that I love about Crisis Magazine and yourself. You give us straight Catholicism, and God bless you, Eric, and the whole staff at Crisis for doing that.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah, it was interesting because I just did a podcast on Father Altman, and it was interesting in doing the preparation for it. I had not followed the story super closely, and I had some concerns about, about Father Altman's tone, how he's handling stuff like that. But as I did preparation, I did the research, I realized there is nothing there that you could ever, can even come close to rising to the idea of removing faculties. I mean, it was just... You could argue this little point or that, how he said something, but nothing where we're talking removal of faculties. And we're talking about, I mean, every human being makes prudential decisions, and sometimes they're good, sometimes they're not. But I realized that there's no heresy there. There's no accusations of any wrongdoing. There's nothing like that. And so it just really is a situation where I agree with you that the attacking our own and trying to critique every single thing that a Father Altman or like you do or something like that, it just furthers the cause of evil, frankly. And so it really is a shame when we do
that.
We
need good priests. It's as simple as that. We need priests that are solid, that are Catholic. All right. And again, I hate using these terms, but you know, it's not a matter about conservative or liberal. It's a matter about following the teaching and the deposit of faith of the church and giving it to the people. We've been in a crisis for decades now when it comes to catechesis, and we need more priests, not less. And every diocese does. And bishops have to realize, look, you stop worrying about lawsuits, stop looking at your priests as potential problems, and start looking at them like them as sons. Bishop Callahan had a great opportunity to do this the right way. And, you know, I saw someone post this recently that basically said, Bishop Callahan, unknown bishop two days ago, now the most infamous bishop in America. And it's like, you know, to be honest with you, he kind of brought that on himself.
Right.
You know, he could have handled this a lot better. And for those out there that think it's wrong for me to say that, I'd be more than happy to sit down with Bishop Callahan and hear his side of the story. I'm always available to listen to that. And you know what I always tell bishops is start listening to your priests. You know, Bishop Malloy refuses to meet with us. And just to touch on something that we talked about earlier is that my bishop and a lot of bishops across this country are committing the worst abuse a parent can commit. And that is the abuse of neglect. They're just neglecting. I mean, it's been years since Bishop Malloy reached out to meet with me. And bear in mind, when he did reach out to meet with me, it was, you come alone while I have both a civil attorney and a canon lawyer next to me while I meet with you. But you can't bring a canon lawyer and you can't bring a civil attorney. And it's like, no, Bishop, come on. Let's meet one-on-one, man-to-man. Or if you want an attorney, then I get to bring an attorney. And same with canon lawyers. Why is that so difficult? I mean, that's what I ask.
Yeah, again, it's a father-son relationship. Why can't you meet as father and son? You know, that you don't bring a lawyer in when you're meeting with your son, hopefully. And if you do, like you said, each side gets their own, gets equal representation. Now, last question is, what can the laity do to help support canceled priests?
First and foremost, fast and pray. But as St. John Henry Newman says, the two wings that get us to heaven. And it's absolutely true. We need a lot more penance, both among the clergy and the laity. In this country, we need a lot more prayer, rosary. Always support your priests. Make sure that you invite them, you know, for Christmas, Easter, Thanksgiving, major events. You know, I'm living with my dad, which is very fortunate. I have very good friends. You know, I'm always have a place to go, but some priests are just lonely. You know, they might be too old where their parents are died or their family moved away. And, you know, they don't have anyone nearby. That's true. But just be out there and just let them know that you support them. Let them know that you're there if they need something. And that's one of the reasons we started the coalition. And I've been just awed by the laity's response in helping us as we get this coalition off the ground. And we don't want to be one of these things that just comes and then just disappears very quickly. We want to make sure that we're there. Even if I'm returned to ministry, I want to be a part of this so that priests that are removed, you know, have a voice to speak for them. So I always tell the laity, pray for them, make sure that they know that you have their back with whatever they need. And you know, that doesn't mean that you need to sell your house in order to pay for their lawyers. What that does mean is that the priest knows that you're there supporting them the best way you can.
That's great. Great. Okay. So I encourage everybody to go to cancelpriests.org and check out the organization. And more than anything, absolutely, pray and fast for our bishop, pray and fast for our priest. I mean, I say that, I've said that before, and I'll say it again, and I appreciate you saying that, Father. We just have to do that, and be willing to support your priest materially, and support your priest, you know, just with community support and things like that. So thank you very much for coming on, Father. I really appreciate it. God bless you. God bless your work you're doing, and all the canceled priests out there. We're really going to keep them all in our prayers. So
thank you, Eric. God bless you as well. Have a great day.
Thank you very much. Until next time, everybody. God love you.